Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This episode features an hour with Malcolm Gladwell from his talk as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2013. To say Malcolm Gladwell's work is widely read is a bit of an understatement. His books don't just appear on the bestseller list, they move in and take up residence there. The Tipping Point spent over 400 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. That means if you were a child starting kindergarten when it first appeared on the list, it was still on the list when you entered middle school. Gladwell came to Portland in October 2013 to speak about his new book, David and Goliath. The central question for Gladwell is, why do underdogs keep fighting even when the odds of winning are minuscule and the consequences of losing are enormous? It's not logical, right? Well, the answer, according to Gladwell, may not be what you think and has more to do with the perception of legitimacy than it does the odds. Not only is his talk irreverent and funny, but it ends with a counterintuitive twist that ties together people and time periods that at first seem incongruous. And even better, the talk tells a story you can't find in David and Goliath, even though it beautifully illustrates his main argument. Here's Gladwell.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here in Portland. I have a deep affection for this city. I feel like I would be a perfect Portlander. I'm a big runner. I spend all of my time in coffee shops, and I'm a Canadian, so I have a whole complex about my much larger and better known neighbor. That's Portland. So tonight I'm not going to tell a story from my book, because why would I? Why would I ruin the reading experience? It's like giving away the ending of the movie before you go to the movie. So what I'm going to do instead is tell a story that is related to one of the themes of the book and. Cast some of the ideas in the book in a slightly different light. The idea that I'm interested in exploring is something that I spend a fair bit of time on in David and Goliath, which is this question of why do underdogs fight? Why we have all these cases in all kinds of contexts where the weaker party in a conflict continues to rebel long after we feel like they should, when the odds seemed overwhelmingly stacked against them, when the logic of the situation would suggest that what they really should do is give up. But they don't give up. They keep fighting. And the question is, why does that happen? And so I thought I would tell a story tonight which reflects on that question. And it's a story about a woman named Alva Smith. And she is one of the great unsung heroes of the 20th century. She plays a key role in the suffragette movement at the beginning of the 20th century. And the reason she's so interesting is that there is almost nothing in the life of Alva Smith that would explain why she became such a radical. It's a mystery, a really interesting mystery. And so I thought if we looked at the life of Alva Smith, maybe we can get some insight into this broader question of why underdogs persist in the way that they do. Now, Alva Smith actually has three names. Alva Belmont is the name that she dies with. Alva Vanderbilt is the name that she is most famous for having. And Alva Smith is the name that she's born with. And we'll start with that. She was born in Mobile, Alabama, and her father was a kind of moderately successful businessman, and they moved to New York City when she's quite young. And she is a remarkable child. I say remarkable in quotes. She's a pain in the neck. She is this obstreperous, unstoppable, indomitable, obnoxious, domineering kid who gets into fights and bosses people around, and has a fierce temper and is constantly upset at the way she's treated by little boys. And She's really short, even as an adult, and she has long hair that goes gray when she's already in only in her 20s, comes all the way down her back, and she has a very severe face. One of her friends, intending to be nice, once said that she resembled a Pekingese. As I said, that was perhaps an overly generous account. I would have said she resembled a pit bull in more ways than one. In any case, she has grand ambitions for herself, and she realizes that as a woman in the 19th century, those ambitions are impossible to realize without social standing and money. And she doesn't have any money, but she casts her eye around New York society because she realizes she could probably find someone who has some money. And her eye alights on a young man named Willie Vanderbilt, who is this handsome, charming, spoiled playboy who just happens to be the grandson of Commodore Vanderbilt, who was in the 19th century the richest man in the world. So they marry, and she bears him a daughter named Consuelo, and then two more sons, and she throws all of her considerable energy into being one of the most conspicuous consumers in the history of conspicuous consumption, which, for those of us who have lived through the 21st century, is quite an accomplishment. The first thing she does is she buys 800 acres on Long Island, and she brings in a whole series of architects to build her family a summer house, something in shingles by the bay. And then she takes over an entire city block on the corner of 52nd Street and Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, and she builds herself a French chateau, which costs $3 million in $1,900, which is a couple hundred million dollars in today's money. And to get a sense of what this house was like, I'm going to read to you a short description from one of the many books that have been written about the real estate portfolio of Alva Vanderbilt, which fall into the category of what might be termed real estate porn. Here is the most succinct description I can find of the house. Everywhere was everything. Walls of red African marble, of stamped leather, walls hung with silk, blue silk brocade, with red velvet embroidered with leaves, flowers, and butterflies, enriched with cut crystal and precious stones, ceilings of mahogany, of bronze, of colored glass, of bamboo, wainscoting of rosewood inlaid with mother of pearl and brass, ebony inlaid with ivory, polished ebony inlaid with satinwood, and Grecian, Oriental, Elizabethan, English, Renaissance, French, and Victorian touches. In crowded rooms bursting with bronze, stained glass, marble, mosaics, and friezes. Then she decides she wants a yacht. The largest private yacht ever built, 285 feet, and it's called the Alva. How hard was that? It has a staff of 52. Then she decides she wants a country house in Newport, Rhode Island, about which I think I'm not going to give you the full description. The quickest way to describe it is that she has to build a special harbor in Rhode Island because she is importing 500,000 cubic feet of white marble from Italy just for the facade. So now she has a city house, a country house, a cottage in Rhode Island, and a yacht with a staff of 52. And so she turns her attention to the apple of her eye, her daughter Consuelo. Now Consuelo was always this very shy girl, but Alva has the highest of expectations for her. She makes her wear a corset at all times with one of those metal rods in the back to make sure that Consuelo had perfect posture. And she insists that Consuelo converse with the family only in French. And every Friday afternoon, Consuelo is required to recite a long poem in German to her mother. And if Consuelo made the slightest mistake in public, she would be ridiculed by Alva. And as Consuelo enters adolescence, Alva starts to dream big dreams for her daughter, and she gets it into her head that what she really wants to do is to marry her daughter into English royalty. Now, this is quite a common notion at the time among the very wealthy families of the United States. There was a common practice in which the daughters of robber barons were married off to the sons of penurious English royalty, aristocracy. In fact, this was such a common practice that there was a name for it. It was called cash for class. But in typical fashion, Alva sets her sights on the greatest prize of them all, who was a young English nobleman named Charles Richard John Spencer Churchill, or Sonny for short. And he was the 9th Duke of Marlborough, the first cousin of Winston Churchill, the direct ancestor of Lady Diana, and the direct heir to Blenheim Palace, one of the largest private houses in the world, whose main building comprised 7 acres, and which made Alva's French chateau in the corner of 52nd and Fifth Avenue look like a ranch-style bungalow. Blenheim Palace, however, is falling apart, and the Duke hasn't got the money to fix it up. And the minute Alva realizes this, she realizes that this man will make the perfect match for her daughter. Now, there are two problems with this idea. The first is that Sonny is not, in fact, Sonny. That is an inaccurate description of his personality. He is a miserable sod, as the English would say. To give you some sense of what he's like, his second wife, Emily Deacon, would sleep with a revolver by her bedside in case he should come to her in the middle of the night. The second problem is that Consuelo is in love with someone else, a young, handsome man named Winthrop Rutherford, who is this devilishly good-looking, accomplished dancer, a great sportsman who comes from one of the best families in New York. And when she turns 18, Wintry, as he was known, begins to woo Consuelo ardently. And on her birthday, she gets a single long-stemmed rose. And there's no note attached, but she knows who it's from. It's from Wintry. And shortly thereafter, she goes for a bicycle ride with Wintry and her mother. Alva is, of course, acting as chaperone. And as they approach a curve in the road, Wintry and Consuelo ride as fast as they can to get ahead. And just as they go out of sight of Alva, Wintry turns to Consuelo and he proposes to her. And Alva understands that something is up, and as fast as her little legs can pedal, she catches up and she looks at Wintry and she looks at her daughter and she realizes instinctively what has happened. And so the next day she takes Consuelo and she whisks her off to Paris. And Wintry writes one love letter after another to his beloved Consuelo, and Alva intercepts every one, right? And then Wintry comes to Paris to try and meet Consuelo, and Alva has the footman at the gates of their house stop him. And then Consuelo is taken by Alva to the house in Newport. And once again, Wintry shows up to try and talk to and meet his betrothed. But Alva locks up her daughter like Rapunzel in the castle and refuses to let her out. And finally, Consuelo has had enough. And she marches up the grand marble staircase to Alva's opulent bedroom, which is complete with cherubs holding swords, or holding shields that have on them emblazoned the letter A, of course. And she confronts her mother and says, "I'm gonna marry Wintry, I'm in love with him." And Alva rises up and says, "You are going to be a duchess. Do you understand what that means?" And Consuelo looks at her and says nothing in a kind of mute defiance. And at that point, Alva flies into a rage because no one ever defies her. And she begins to denounce Wintry with absolutely every bit of invective in her vocabulary. And Consuelo realizes that it's hopeless. There's no way she can win the day against her formidable mother. And she gives up. And on November 6th, 1895, New York City witnesses one of the grandest weddings in its history. The daughter of one of the wealthiest men in the country is married off to one of the most eligible bachelors in all of England, the heir to one of the grandest titles in all of England. And Alva takes over St. Thomas's Church on Fifth Avenue, and she has 80 decorators fill the church with wildflowers, and she puts on this extraordinary blue satin dress with a border of Russian sable, and she marches up the aisle with her two sons side by side. And you can imagine the scene outside. Every reporter in the country has come to cover the wedding of the century, right? And there are crowds outside and people straining at the police barricades. And in the front of the church, there is Alva, proud, right? Flanked by her two sons, waiting for her daughters so she can marry her off to this prince, this English prince. And she waits, first 5 minutes, then 10 minutes, then 15, then 20. Where is Consuelo? Well, Consuelo is back at home, sobbing inconsolably in her father's arms. And finally, she pulls it together and they fix her makeup and they get her clothes on and they bring her to the church and the minister pronounces them man and wife, and immediately Alva whisks her daughter and her husband into a back room and the prenup is signed. And Sonny is given $2.5 million up front and the promise of $100,000 a year for life. And then the newlyweds climb into a carriage and they drive off down Fifth Avenue. And Sonny turns to Consuelo and says coldly, I don't love you. I'm never going to love you. Your responsibility is to bear me an heir and fix up the castle. Right? And standing on the steps of the church is Alva, watching the carriage recede into the distance, and her eyes are filled with tears, right? The down at her heels girl from Mobile, Alabama, is now the mother of a duchess. This is Alva's moment of greatest triumph, or so it seems, because at this point, her story starts to get interesting. Now, I think you can see why Alva is an unlikely radical, right? Exceedingly rich people who boss everyone about and live in grand houses are not generally thought of as radical material, right? This is like one of the Kardashian sisters joining the Occupy movement. It's on its face, just a little improbable. So how do we account for it? How do we account for the transformation she would later undergo? Well, I think it's important to try and understand, before we answer that question, get a deeper understanding of why do people rebel in the first place? What are the kinds of drivers of that kind of transformation? That's obviously an important issue, but there have been a series of fairly common sense theories put forth to account for this over the years. The most common is the one favored by many economists and political scientists, is the idea of deterrence, right? We defy authority as a matter of costs and benefits. When the costs of breaking the law are lower than the benefits of breaking the law, we break the law. And when the costs grow greater than the benefits, we don't, right? It's an awful lot of intuitive sense in that idea. And we only have to look at examples in history that back it up. One of the ones most beloved of criminologists is what happened in Montreal in 1970 when the police force went on a 19-hour strike, right? The minute the police walked off the job, the city descended into chaos. There were gun battles in the middle of the street. There were so many bank robberies that day that the banks had to shut their doors. This is a normally law-abiding, civilized city. This is Canada. And it descends into complete chaos. Why? Well, because the costs of law-breaking were effectively zero for those 19 hours. The problem with this idea, though, is that there are tons and tons of examples where where deterrence theory doesn't seem to work, right? Where it doesn't have any explanatory power. So, for example, let's use the case of tax paying. It's one of the basic requirements of a modern state is that we're all obliged to pay our taxes. But it turns out there are huge differences between among countries in the level of honesty that citizens display on tax day. There are countries like Greece and Italy where the underground economy is enormous, where cheating is the rule rather than an exception. And then there's places like here in the United States where rates of cheating on tax day are actually incredibly low. The size of the underground economy in the United States on a per capita basis is about a third that of Greece or Italy. We're honest on April 15th. Now, if deterrence theory would explain that, it would suggest that that must mean that the costs associated with cheating on your taxes are higher here than anywhere else in the world, right? Now, is that the case? No, it's not. In fact, the costs associated with cheating on your taxes in the United States are lower than anywhere else. We have, if you compare the penalties that the IRS doles out for tax evasion in this country, they're a fraction of what they are in Europe or in other parts of the world. And if you look at the percentage of people whose taxes are audited in this country, they're a tiny fraction of the audit rates in other parts of the world. We have one of the most lax tax enforcement regimens anywhere, right? In fact, logically, you should cheat on your taxes. Why? Because you're not going to get caught, right? Here's another complication of deterrence theory. If deterrence really matters, then in cases where the penalties for criminal behavior are dramatically increased overnight in a short period of time, we should see an immediate corresponding drop in the crime rate, right? If you dramatically raise the costs of breaking the law, people should stop breaking the law. So is this true, right? Well, it turns out that just to the south of here, there was a fabulous case study in this very thing. In 1994, California passed three strikes legislation, which was, in retrospect, probably the most extreme example of penal reform in the history of the West. It was incredible what California did, right? They took penalties for even ordinary crimes that used to be like this and turned them into this. Your third strike, your third offense, almost regardless of what it was, even if it was something as simple as theft, right, would result in a prison sentence of 25 years to life. Within 10 years, the number of people behind bars in California doubled. Right? The per capita imprisonment rate in California ended up being 7 times the per capita imprisonment rate in places like Canada and Western Europe. Right? That's really extreme. So after California takes this extreme step and dramatically erases the costs of committing crimes, did the crime rate fall in California? Right? Should have been a really simple, easy question. Did it? Well, the answer is we don't know. Can't figure it out. Something happened in California. Crime did come down a little bit, but then crime came down everywhere in the United States in the mid-1990s, even in places where they didn't dramatically raise the costs of breaking the law. To this day, if you look at this question, what you will see is like 100 different studies on the question, some of which said crime kind of came down, some said, well, it didn't come down at all, and some actually claim very plausibly that as a result of three strikes legislation, serious violent crime in California ended up being higher than it would have been otherwise. That's not a very strong endorsement of the idea of deterrence, is it? As a result of all of these problems, a group of legal scholars have, in recent years, begun to put forth a second, very different theory to explain why people choose to obey or disobey authority. And what they've said is that what matters is not so much the content of the law, but rather how the law is enforced. People obey the laws, this group argues, when they perceive them to be legitimate. Now, what does that mean? Well, legitimacy has three prongs. The first prong of legitimacy is, do I feel like I have standing? By that I mean, do people feel like when they speak up, if they're treated unfairly, do they feel like they'll be heard, right? Do I have a voice in the process? That's the first prong. The second prong of legitimacy is, do people feel like they're being treated with respect? In other words, is the system fundamentally fair? Does it treat everyone the same, or are some groups singled out for prejudicial treatment and other groups given a special deal, right? And the third question is the administration of law trustworthy? Do we have a reasonable expectation that the way things are today is a good predictor of the way things are tomorrow? Or is everything going to be thrown into chaos and controversy just around the corner? Now, with these three principles in mind, think back to the example of taxes. Why do Americans pay their taxes? Because we perceive our system as being legitimate. Now, I know we bitch and moan about it all the time, but the bottom line is we got it better here than almost anywhere else in the world, right? Do we believe we have voice when it comes to our taxes? Do we believe if we have a problem with our taxes, we can speak up and be heard? Absolutely, right? That's the function of the Republican Party, is to listen to people's complaints about their taxes, right? Do we believe the system is fair? Does it treat most people according to a common standard? Well, it's not perfectly fair. It has some problems, but it's not bad, right? It's pretty good at the end of the day. Do we feel the system is trustworthy, right? Does it radically get blown up and changed overnight? No, it's been pretty consistent, right? You have an idea about what your taxes are going to be like next year and the year after that and the year after that. You add all those things up, and you have a system in which people will obey the law, right? Almost regardless of what the law says, because they believe in a system that enforces the law. Now, compare that to Greece. What's the problem in Greece that causes so many people to cheat on their taxes? Is it a lack of enforcement? No, nothing to do with enforcement. It has to do with the fact that people in Greece genuinely and sincerely and correctly do not believe their system is legitimate. They don't have standing and voice. They can't speak up and be heard if they're being treated badly. Is the system fair and neutral in Greece? Absolutely not. People are cutting special deals and bribing their way into the good graces of tax inspectors and going on and on and on. Do they believe the system is trustworthy? It's anything but trustworthy. Under those kinds of circumstances, none of us would pay our taxes either. And why didn't three strikes have a discernible effect on California? Well, maybe if you lock up that many people, and maybe if you start sending people to jail for 25 years for stealing slices of pizza, as did happen in the early days of three strikes, maybe what you've done is just created a legitimacy problem. I remember reading this statistic that I will never forget. It looked at the imprisonment rates among young black men. And the one that caught my eye was young black high school dropouts born in the second half of the 1970s were their chances of being behind bars at some point in their life were 69%. Right? Basically, we locked up an entire generation of young black men. Now, if you were from one of the communities that one of those young black men was from, do you think you would perceive the criminal justice system as legitimate? Do you think you would think you had a voice in how that criminal justice system operated? Do you think that after looking at the fact that almost everyone, every man you know was behind bars, do you think you would believe the system was neutral and treated different groups of Americans fairly? And do you think you would believe that the system was trustworthy? Right. No, you wouldn't. Right. So what happens in places where there is no legitimacy? Well, people rebel. They get angry. They feel under no compulsion to obey the law. In places like Greece, they just cheat on their taxes. In poor communities around this country, they continue to commit crimes, right? Nothing serves as a greater engine of defiance than the condition of being denied standing, and neutrality. Which brings us back to Alva, right? Because she lived in a society that did not grant her legitimacy. Now that seems hard to believe because she was so rich, right? Unimaginably rich. 52 servants alone on her yacht. She built castles. She lived a life that most of us can only dream of. But the truth is that she occupies an exceedingly narrow and restricted world. Right? She and the other wives in New York society at the turn of the last century were basically confined to their houses. They were allowed to have lunch with each other and to hold dinners and to boss around their servants, but that was it. They couldn't work. They couldn't effectively leave the home. They couldn't play any kind of role in public affairs. They couldn't vote. They couldn't do anything that wasn't within the domestic space, right? Divorce was unheard of. They were expected to keep their mouth shut and stay at home. The men, meanwhile, could have, do whatever they wanted to. They could have jobs. They could work on Wall Street. They could go to the country club. They spend evenings at their private establishments in the city. They roam free. The way the divorce laws were written at the time, a man could divorce a woman if simply by accusing her of infidelity. For a woman to divorce a man, she had to prove infidelity and physical cruelty. Right? A man of wealth in that era could satisfy every one of his whims, and they did. The rich men in the world in which the Vanderbilts moved would go off on their yachts and bring along call girls and have wild parties and put up their mistresses in apartments in the city. And Willie Vanderbilt, Alva's husband, was that's exactly the kind of life he lived, right? He was a playboy. He didn't work for a living. He'd never worked. He inherited this gigantic fortune, and he was handsome and charming, and he had one affair after another openly and flagrantly in front of his family. Meanwhile, Alva was required to stay at home and play the role of dutiful wife. From the outside, she looks like she is this triumphant society hostess, but in fact, she's desperately unhappy. In fact, she would later in her memoirs describe the years leading up to Consuelo's marriage as the saddest of her life. She and Willie had begun to argue. She met a guy, a man named August Belmont, Oliver Belmont, and she falls in love with him, but it's hopeless, right? She can't have, a woman of her standing can't have an affair with a man the way a man in that world could have an affair with a woman. So finally, desperate to save her marriage, she says to Willie, look, let's go away. And the whole family goes, gets on a boat and goes to Paris. But what happens in Paris? It's a disaster. She discovers that not only is her husband having an affair with her best friend, but he's also walking around Paris openly with this prostitute named Nellie Neustrater, right? And she's completely humiliated. Finally, she says enough, and she kicks him out of the house. She demands a divorce. But of course, divorce is something in those years that's simply not done, right? And everyone in her life tells her you can't do it. The lawyer who she engages to handle her divorce petitions begs her to withdraw it. Everyone tries to stop her. The tabloids gear up and just go after her. I mean, can you imagine? This is one of the biggest stories of the year. The most highest profile couple in all of New York society have fallen apart publicly. She comes out of Trinity Church in Newport, where she has been going her whole life. And all of the people who she thought of as her friends turn their backs on her and don't even acknowledge her. She's completely ostracized. But she feels she has no choice, right? The situation is impossible. Later, when she writes her memoirs, there's this incredibly poignant passage where she describes the plight of women of that era. She says, it was considered religious, dignified, and correct for the wife to withdraw into the shadows while her husband paid the family respects to the sunshine. She was supposed to get her sunlight by proxy through the husband. And that heartbreaking phrase, sunlight by proxy, I think helps to put some of Alva's behavior into perspective. You know, here is this brilliant, ambitious, headstrong, powerful woman. If she was alive today, she would have started a company. She would be running some entrepreneurial enterprise. She would be out in the world doing something of real value. But she can't do that in 1900, right? None of those options are available to her. She has one option available to her, and that is she is allowed to oversee the building of houses. And that sounds like this horrible, tacky, obscene act of conspicuous consumption. But look, think about it from her perspective. This is a woman who needs a project to feel fulfilled, right? To have some kind of outlet for her tremendous intelligence and energy. And this is all she's got. The society that she lives in says, you can only do one thing, build houses. So what's her response? Okay, I'll build houses. This also makes, I think, sense of her seemingly inexcusable behavior over her daughter's love for Winthrop Rutherford. At the time that Wintry begins to woo Consuelo, she is 18, but he's 33. And he is, what is he? Well, he's this wealthy playboy. He comes from a family that, as the tabloids would say, was best known for wearing expensive clothing, right? He spends all of his days playing golf or polo at the Newport Country Club. When she looks at him, she sees another version of the man she married, an idle, decadent, brainless philanderer who would sentence her daughter to a lifetime of misery and uselessness. By contrast, what does the Duke of Marlborough represent? Well, he's an odious cad, but at least he's from in another country. At least he's in another society. At least if she married him, she would have a title and position in a world that would allow her to be heard if she chose to speak up, right? She would have clout if she married Sonny. Now, to our modern ears, of course, that sounds incredibly cynical. We believe in love. And here is a woman who is in love with Wintry Rutherford. But 100 years ago, in the position that Alva and Consuelo were in, women were treated as property by their society. And Alva believes, I think correctly, that love is a luxury her daughter cannot afford. Consuelo is her great hope, and she is going to be damned if her daughter is going to squander her life the same way she believes her life was squandered. So that moment when Consuelo and Sonny are pulling away in the carriage and Alva's eyes are filled with tears, they're not tears of joy. It's this tragic moment for her. She has been forced to make a series of incredibly impossible choices. She has had to alienate her own daughter in order to save her own daughter. She wants to divorce her husband, and because he's humiliated her, right? Running around with every woman under the sun, and society, all of her own friends, are going to turn against her. She is a woman in an indescribably difficult and hellish place. But she doesn't turn back, right? She doesn't give up. And why doesn't she give up? Because she does not accept her society's judgment against her as legitimate. They haven't given her standing, right? She doesn't have a voice. She's not allowed to stand up and be heard about the inequities of her position. No, a woman's role is to keep her mouth shut and stay in the home. Society isn't neutral, right? They're not impartial in the way they treat her. On the contrary, no, there's one set of rules for men and one set of rules for women. Willie gets to run around with a French prostitute all day. She's not allowed to be with Oliver Belmont, a man that she loves. So Alva, in that moment, is in that same position that all radicals are when they are in that period of transformation. She's angry. Now, one of the questions that I try to answer in David and Goliath is why it's so hard for people in positions of power to understand the importance and the significance of this kind of anger. I have a chapter in the book where I talk about a really remarkable woman named Joanne Jaffe, who is the chief of housing police in New York City. And she's the person who is responsible for maintaining law and order in all of the housing projects in New York, some of the worst neighborhoods in the whole city. And what is remarkable about her is that she is someone who decided to take legitimacy really, really seriously. And she understood, the thing that she understood when she looked at all of the kids who were robbing and stealing and committing crimes on the streets of New York and in the housing projects of New York, is that they did not perceive the police as a legitimate force in their community. So Joe and Jaffe set out to try and restore that principle in the eyes of these kids. And so she hired police officers who loved kids. And she set up these task forces of police officers, not in some distant police station, but in trailers in the parking lots of housing projects. And she set out to meet the families of every one of the juvenile delinquents in these neighborhoods. And on Thanksgiving Day, she brought them turkeys. And on Christmas Day, she would invite them all to a party and give them presents and come up to every one of those little kids and give them a big hug. Right? Now that sounds crazy. It sounds like the worst kind of parody of do-gooding liberalism, right? It's the kind of thing that makes us roll our eyes. But if you look at the crime rates in those neighborhoods over the last 5 years and see how dramatically they have fallen, you understand that she's onto something. That the practice of policing and the imposition of law and order in a difficult neighborhood does not work unless you first establish the principle of legitimacy. She understood how dangerous it is when someone gets angry, right? Now, how few people in positions of power understand that? Right? Very few. The people in Alva's world didn't understand that. So back to Alva, here we have this woman who is angry and who is unhappy, and she's been denied legitimacy by the society of which she's a part. She's this ticking time bomb. And in one of the great ironies, the thing that finally sets her off is her daughter, Consuelo. Consuelo, in the years of her marriage to Sonny, has been transformed. She bears him two sons, and she would always refer to them as an heir and a spare. And she stays with him for 10 years, and then she leaves him. And she conducts herself with such dignity, and she has won over so many elements of English society, and he is such a complete jerk that no one holds it against her. Everyone rallies around her. And once she's established on her own, she turns herself into one of the leading philanthropists in all of England. She develops a social conscience. She becomes the one who stands up and speaks out for the things that are important. And in 1908, she returns to New York City, and she's now this tall, beautiful, charismatic woman. And she gives a famous speech at the Waldorf Astoria in front of all of the assembled women of society in New York. And what she discovered in her years in England was that English society was far more open to women than American society was. That it was possible in England for women of means and standing to speak up, to play a real role in public affairs, to express themselves, to make impassioned arguments on behalf of social justice. And in the speech that Consuelo gives, she basically chides the women of New York for playing dead, for not speaking up, for submitting to this regimen of discrimination and patriarchy. She tells them that they have been marginalized. They have been pushed to the fringes by men. They have been slaves to their men, she says, and she urges them to stand up and to fight. And as she says this, Alva is sitting in the audience, right? And you can only imagine how she feels. 15 years ago, she had sent her daughter off in tears, right? Took her away from the man she loved. Why? Because she wanted to save her. And what has happened 15 years later? Her daughter has come back and she is saved. And afterwards, mother and daughter get together after the speech is over, and Consuelo turns to Alva and she says, "You know, in spite of all that happened, I'm glad I married an Englishman." Right? And it's as if Alva has been offered absolution. This big weight of guilt is lifted off her back. And not long after that, she accepts an invitation to go to a speech, and the speech is about women's suffrage, because, of course, in that era, women in almost all states in the United States, and in fact in most countries throughout the West, were not allowed to vote, or they had very limited voting rights. And what Alva realizes as she sits in the audience is that until women have the right to vote, they're never going to be seen as legitimate players in society. They're never going to be granted voice. They're never going to be treated impartially and fairly, right? The only way to make it happen is to bring about the vote. And she looks at the campaign for women's rights that is going on right now, right at that point in America, and she realizes that it's going nowhere. In that period, there were only four American states that had given women the right to vote: Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, and Idaho. And all that had been done years ago, and they were not central to the conversation at all. The cause had no money, it had no visibility, it had no strategic direction, it had no energy. And all of that is perfect for Alva. Why? Because she has those four things in abundance. So she moves in and she takes over. And she moves the headquarters of the suffragette movement from Warren, Ohio, where it was for God knows what reason, and moves it into a big brand new spanking building on Fifth Avenue in New York City. And she takes her cottage in Newport Beach, and she turns it into basically a convention center for the suffragette movement and holds one meeting after another there to the horror of all of her fancy neighbors. And when a group of female garment workers in New York City, the most downtrodden of all of the workers in the city at that time, when they finally go on strike to protest the horrendous working conditions that they operate under, who leads the battle? Alva does. And she actually physically goes downtown and leads a march of all these women through downtown. And when they're arrested and hauled before a judge, who sits in the courtroom and bails them out and spends all night staring at the judge until he gets them free? Alva does. And who is the first person to stand up and say, wait a minute, Black women need to be part of this movement? Alva is the first person to do that. And she invites the Negro Women's League to join the cause. And when the movement gets really conservative, people think maybe we're pushing too quickly here, and all kinds of naysayers begin to say, maybe we shouldn't do this because we're antagonizing men. Alva stands up and says, wait a minute, men never worry about antagonizing men. Why are we, right? And during the Second World War, when all kinds of people say, well, there's a war on now, now is not the time for women to be asked to be treated fairly, Alva says, nonsense. Now is precisely the time that we should be agitating for being treated fairly. And she makes sure that the pickets for women's suffrage stay up outside the White House every single day of the war. She puts every ounce of her obsessive, manipulative, domineering, ambitious, outrageous personality into the cause. And what happens? Well, the first thing that happens is that she's ostracized. People turn their backs on her, right? They drum her out of polite society. But the second thing that happens is that on August 18th, 1920, the 19th Amendment to the US Constitution is ratified, and women, for the first time in American history, win the right to vote. Right? Alva wins. And the lesson of that day applies as equally today as it did 80 years ago. And that is that if you deny people legitimacy, they will one day, by one means or another, come back and defeat you. One last thing. Alva dies in January of 1933 from a stroke, and her funeral is held at St. Thomas's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue, the same place where Consuelo had gotten married so many years before. And 20 of the country's most prominent feminists serve as her pallbearers. And the limousines line up on either side of the street, and the press descends on Manhattan to record this historic event. And the congregation sings three hymns to mark her passing. The first is a hymn by Harriet Beecher Stowe. The second is the suffragette battle song, The March of the Women. And the third is a hymn composed by Alva herself, right? Which is the perfect summary of this strange and wonderful woman. And the hymn is all about how when Alva gets to heaven, she's damned if she is going to let a man like St. Peter stand in judgment of her. And it begins, no waiting, no waiting at the gates of paradise. No tribunal of men to judge. The watchers of the tower proclaim a daughter of the king. Thank you.
That was Malcolm Gladwell speaking at the Arlene Schützer Concert Hall in 2013. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.